suis très heureuse d'accueillir Wendy Bellion. Donc Wendy Bellion, qui est professeure invitée du programme Terra INHA. Wendy Bellion, qui est associate professor à l'University of Delaware, qui a publié de nombreux travaux sur l'Amérique de la période coloniale ainsi que de la période post-révolutionnaire. On peut citer notamment son livre Citizen Spectator, Art, Illusion and Visual Perception in Early National America, qui est paru en 2011 et qui a reçu la même année le prix Charles Eldridge, décerné par le Smithsonian American Art Museum. Un ouvrage qui portait sur l'art du trompe-l'œil aux États-Unis dans la période post-révolutionnaire et qui reliait de façon très intéressante la question de l'illusion d'optique et de la perception de l'acuité visuelle à la question de la constitution d'une identité citoyenne dans donc, cette période de l'Amérique post-révolutionnaire. On peut signaler également un numéro spécial du Winter Tour Portfolio en 2011, co-dirigé avec Monica Dominguez-Torres, qui portait sur la culture matérielle de l'Amérique du Nord de la période coloniale, envisagée dans une perspective transcoloniale. Voilà, et donc Wendy travaille actuellement un livre qui s'intitulera « What Statues Remember, Iconoclasm and Ritual in New York City », dont elle va nous parler plus particulièrement ce soir. Voilà, alors avant de lui céder la parole, je voudrais aussi signaler que donc nous poursuivons demain les événements autour de l'art américain avec donc une journée d'études organisée par Sarah Arquino, qui est la postdoctorante du programme Terra INHA, et vous avez donc les programmes de cette journée d'études sur vos sièges, également à la sortie de la salle. Voilà, et vous dire également que vous êtes tous très cordialement invités tout à l'heure à l'issue de cette conférence à prendre un verre en bas au rez-de-chaussée en salle Abbey-Warburg. Voilà, donc je cède la parole à Wendy Bellion et je la remercie à nouveau d'avoir bien voulu présenter cette conférence ce soir.
Merci Larissa et bonsoir. Je vais parler en anglais, so I hope that will be all right with everyone. If you don't understand what I'm saying, please don't hesitate to stop me and I will try and explain in French. So I'm very pleased to be here tonight, and this talk comes near the end of my time here in Paris as the Terra visiting professor. So I would like to take the occasion to express my sincere thanks to the individuals and organizations who have given me such a warm welcome here, the Terra Foundation for American Art and the INHA, as well as the faculties of Paris 7, Paris 10, the École Normale Supérieure, and the Université François Rabelais in Tours. My interactions with scholars here and the research that I've done in museums and libraries has been truly helpful for thinking about issues of iconoclasm, both past and present. If this talk marks an endpoint of sorts, however, I hope it will also help to introduce some of the issues that many of us will continue to explore tomorrow at the Journée d'études organized by my Terra and INHA colleague, Sarah Arshino. Effacer, remplacer, omettre, nier. Erased, replaced, omitted, denied. How, the symposium will ask, do such issues pertain within constructions of American art history? What, and here I paraphrase from Sarah's description for the event, what has been lost, forgotten, or suppressed in the construction of an American art history? What has been removed, and why? These are questions that I myself have been thinking a lot about over the last several years in the course of researching and writing a new book about iconoclasm and American culture. In a nutshell, this is a project that concerns the creation, destruction, and dispersal of a small body of political monuments in colonial New York and how those monuments informed cultural memory in later decades and centuries. Let me briefly introduce these objects. They included a series of five tall ship's masts, which you see in the upper left corner, collectively known as Liberty Poles, that were first raised in 1766 to celebrate the repeal of a British tax act called the Stamp Act. Each Liberty pole went up at a public space called the Commons. For those of you who are familiar with New York City, this is now the area of City Hall, about one block east of the World Trade Center. The five poles were raised and destroyed one after the other across the span of a decade from 1766 to 1776. A few blocks away, and on the right side of this image, at the intersection of Wall Street and William Street, New Yorkers installed a marble pedestrian statue of William Pitt the Elder in 1770. Pitt the Elder was a great champion of colonial rights. The statue is now missing its head and both arms, as you can see, but it was draped in a toga and carved in an ad locutio pose to conjure ancient Roman orators. Again, if you know New York City, this was located about one block east of where the New York Stock Exchange stands today. The third monument, which you see at the base, was by far the grandest and remains the best known today. It was a gilded, lead, equestrian statue of King George III. It was created to resemble a famous statue of the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius on the Capitoline Hill. Together with the Pitt statue, the royal statue was installed in 1770 at Bowling Green, a small park at the tip of the island. You've heard of this location, even if you haven't been there, because in 2011, it was the place where the Occupy Wall Street movement began, before slowly moving up Broadway to Zuccotti Park and eventually to Union Square. And this is the first image that the Canadian magazine Adbusters published in calling people out to occupy Wall Street. It suggests the iconic sculpture of Charging Bull, which now occupies the northern end of Bowling Green, as the meeting place, and it advises simply, bring your tent. Now, those two statues, together with the Fifth Liberty Pole, mapped a roughly triangular urban space for six short but tempestuous years between 1770 and 1776. In the opening salvos of the American Revolutionary War, when British troops took New York, all three monuments were partially or wholly destroyed in acts of political iconoclasm. The King statue was the first to go. Notably, the attack was precipitated by one of the most important speech acts in American history, a public reading of the Declaration of Independence. On July 9, 1776, so 5 days after the document was ratified by Congress in Philadelphia, the Declaration of Independence was read aloud to George Washington's troops, who were gathered uptown at the Commons around the base of the Liberty Pole. That night, a crowd of soldiers and sailors swarmed down Broadway to Bowling Green, where they tore the figure of the king from its pedestal, beheaded it, and hacked it into pieces, scratched gilding from its surface, and drew the parts through the streets. The king's head was seized with the intention of mounting it upon a stake. Eventually, it was shipped back to London as proof that the rebels meant business. Most of the statue was carted off to a military depot in the adjacent state of Connecticut, where it was melted down and reshaped into thousands of bullets for the American Army. The first half of my study examines the creation and destruction of these monuments, and the second half examines the afterlife of iconoclasm, for the three monuments never really went away. New Yorkers raised Liberty poles at other locations. Pitt's headless, armless trunk peregrinated around the city for decades. And although much of the king's statue was melted down, several large fragments were saved and concealed by Americans loyal to the crown. Many of these fragments have been consigned to storage facilities out of sight and largely out of mind. Given the subject of tomorrow's Journée d'études, it seems appropriate to note that these fragments have not entered into narratives of American art history, and to question why they remain largely invisible. All except for one, that is, the tail of George III's horse, which has achieved the status of a cultural relic. In 2013, the New York Times identified this artifact as one of the 50 most important objects in the history of New York City. According to the Times, its value adheres in its historical and ideological significance, as opposed to its aesthetic properties. As the text on the right explains, the destruction of the statue of George III was, quote, by some measures, the first official act of rebellion after colonial independence was declared. The New York Historical Society, which owns this fragment, also explicitly draws a connection between the act of iconoclasm that destroyed the Royal Monument and the beginnings of American independence. The horse's tail hangs in the first gallery of the museum. Indeed, it accompanies the headless statue of William Pitt. And the two together frame a 19th century painting that narrates the destruction of the king's statue. As such, this installation participates in a production of representations about iconoclasm that date all the way back to the Revolutionary period. Nearly as soon as the royal statue came down, Americans set about putting it back up and pushing it over again and again and again. This body of visual and performative representations includes paintings and prints, postcards and poems and plays, and even several civic pageants and parades. In my book, I'm asking how this eclectic body of representations continually made and remade historical memories of iconoclasm. In particular, I'm interested in how the act of iconoclasm at Bowling Green became a creation story for New York, something akin to the city's version of Boston's Tea Party, something that allowed later generations to pinpoint the genesis of an American New York, as opposed to a Dutch New York, or a British New York, or even a Native American New York. My research has also entailed asking questions about the prehistory of destruction. For instance, how did three monuments together, not just the king's statue alone, generate spaces of revolutionary meaning and affect? This is important to ask because the Liberty Poles and Pitt statue claim very little visibility within constructions of American art history, but also because these were formidable material things in themselves. They were forms that excited vision and space through their immense scale and gilded surfaces, that were imagined by their admirers and detractors alike to possess qualities of speech and animation akin to that of devotional idols. They were forms that organized colonial soundscapes, ritual practices, and everyday movements around the city. In examining the prehistory of destruction, then, I've been trying to recover something of the spatiality of public monuments and ritual performance in order to complicate the ways in which iconoclasm is ordinarily interpreted. Far too often in historical texts, iconoclasm has been understood as a quick and spontaneous act of human anger, as if no premeditation was involved, as if an attack on a statue could transpire rapidly, as if it was over as soon as it had begun. This has something to do, I think, with the sorts of questions that scholars have tended to ask about iconoclasm. Many years ago, for example, the art historian David Friedberg asked, and I quote, "Why should an attack on an image seem to be an appropriate method of making a political point?" It's an entirely reasonable question. But it's one that represents iconoclasm as an action that people do to things. By focusing instead on the materiality and the spatiality of the thing that is destroyed, we can ask a slightly different question. How do things also affect and act upon people? Such a question puts iconoclasm squarely at the heart of humanities discourses about the agency of things and the implicated nature of the human and non-human. It also compels us to better attend to the spatial and temporal qualities of destruction. Iconoclasm happens in space and in time, but it also happens across spaces and over time, We have to attend to its before and after to understand why it continues to matter to later generations. So let me turn now to that after, the afterlife of iconoclasm, to suggest some of the critical issues that we might consider. To invoke the terms of tomorrow's symposium, iconoclasm would seem to be the ultimate act of negation, erasure, and denial. Acts of political and religious destruction, which often target highly visible and very large things, vary enormously in motive and execution, but most fundamentally alter the appearance of objects and their environment. In the case of three-dimensional objects, like public statues of political leaders, iconoclasm may demolish, dismember, disfigure, scatter, and displace things, such that parts are reduced to pieces or cease to exist at all. Yet, as numerous scholars have argued, iconoclasm is not wholly or even principally an act of erasure. Writing about the Protestant Reformation, Joseph Kerner has observed that the things that iconoclasts assail seldom disappear. Indeed, and I quote, they persist and function by being perpetually destroyed. Iconoclasm, in other words, reifies the significance of the things it wrecks. Likewise, although the Greek word iconoclasm translates into English as image breaking, in practice, iconoclasm often compels remaking. It creates new forms out of the memory or detritus of the old ones. Occasionally, it sizes surpassing the original as if to redress the crimes of iconoclasm with something bigger and better, or even in forms that prove to be collectible. We need only look to the example of the French Revolution for numerous examples of the remnants of the Ancien Régime refashioned into souvenirs, such as the morceau of the Bastille that was saved and embossed with a wax seal that you see on top, or this trompe-l'oeil card table created from the wood of the destroyed prison. These are both objects from the Musée Carnavalet. James Simpson has underscored the seeming paradoxes in these phenomena of making, destroying, and remaking. Describing iconoclasm as a kinetic cycle, he writes that iconoclasm initiates its own tradition. Each attempt to stop the process feeds the process, refreshes energies, and in many cases, produces new materials for the iconoclastic wave. Simpson is referring here primarily to the waves of religious iconoclasm that swept Great Britain during the 16th and 17th centuries. But his observations are equally relevant to the actions that destroyed the King statue in New York and to the modes of representation, from the visual to the material to the performative, that these actions continue to generate right through the present day. I've been speaking in broad strokes about iconoclasm thus far, and I've noted that the actions at Bowling Green spawned a number of artworks. So at this point, I'd like to narrow the scope to focus on one painting and one sculpture produced during a single turbulent decade, the 1850s. The painting is this one, pulling down the statue of King George III, painted by a German immigrant named Johannes Ortel in 1852 or 53. And the sculpture is this one, Henry Kirk Brown's bronze equestrian statue of George Washington, which was installed in Union Square in New York in 1856. In very different ways, both objects intervened in the historical memory of iconoclasm that had become a national creation story as well as a local creation story by the Civil War era. Both objects, moreover, invite us to add another critical term to the vocabulary of erasure and replacement that we'll investigate more tomorrow, namely surrogation. As deployed by Joseph Roach in an important study called Cities of the Dead, Circumatlantic Performance, surrogation describes the process by which cultural memory reproduces and recreates itself. Into the cavities created by loss, through death or other forms of departure, Roach suggests, survivors attempt to fit satisfactory alternatives. But because collective memory works selectively, imaginatively, and often perversely, surrogation rarely, if ever, succeeds. The fit cannot be exact. The search for a suitable substitute may expose lack, may produce excess, and is always troubled by the specter of the double, of the uncanny. It also requires public enactments of forgetting, whether to elide the ruptures created by loss or to reimagine a lost golden time. For Roach, the peculiarity of surrogation as a process of memory formation is most visible in practices of public performance like carnival or Mardi Gras, which so often involve reiterative sounds, gestures, and actions. And I'll just mention that this issue of performance is something that I hope to explore more in a paper I'll be giving in London this coming June as part of a Terra conference on destruction that is co-organized by Hélène Valence, who is here. So I'll be addressing several performative reenactments of the attack on the royal statue that happened across the 20th century. For now, let me simply suggest that Roach's thesis about surrogation, a process of memory making that involves problematic replacements and elisions, is just as helpful in understanding the body of pictorial and material representations engendered by the iconoclasm at Bowling Green. The notion of surrogation draws out troubling ambiguities in Ortel's painting, and it illuminates the complicated status of the Washington statue as a vexed descendant of George III. First, Ortel. Of all the 19th century images that represent the destruction of the royal statue, Ortel's painting stands out for several reasons. Among them are the fact that it was painted by a recent German immigrant following a period of revolutions in Europe, that it was quickly reproduced in the form of an engraving, thereby reaching a larger audience, and also because it remains very visible today. Upon entering the foyer of the New York Historical Society, the first thing one sees is this enlarged and digitized version of Ortel's painting. It quite literally puts iconoclasm into motion. By walking back and forth, visitors trigger sensors that activate figures in the image. For school groups, the drama culminates with the statue crashing to the ground. Now, there's probably much to say about the transition of this image from analog to digital, not to mention why New Yorkers feel the need to keep pulling George III down in 2015. It's even worth pausing for a second to consider the sheer irony of analyzing pictures about iconoclasm. As Erica Nijinsky has observed in her excellent book about monument making in revolutionary era France, entitled Sculpture and Enlightenment, depictions of iconoclasm offer an exegesis on negation that is paradoxically visual in nature. Nijinsky goes on to pose a deceptively straightforward question. How does the representation of destruction work exactly? I'd like to put a version of that question to this painting and engraving and to ask how the appearance and subsequent disappearance of the Indian figures in these scenes raise questions about national inclusions and exclusions. Taken together, the painting and engraving present a rather unique and problematic pair within the genre of images representing Bowling Green, for they at once visualize and suppress the presence of non-white actors in American history, inserting and removing them from a political narrative that is, in some ways, less about the disappearance of a statue than it is about the making of nation. Paradoxically, for an image that is about toppling a regime, Ortel's painting presents a rather stable, even symmetrical composition. The statue forms the apex of a large triangle that extends both left and right to encompass groups of watchful spectators and bellicose agitators. The Indian family at left, cast into shadow and turning away from the action, is counterpoised on the right by an illuminated crowd of white women, children, and elite and laboring men, most of whom turn inward to witness the scene. A similar rhythm of forms occurs across the middle ground. To the left of the pedestal, three white gentlemen calmly observe the attack. On balance, at right, three young laborers tumble to the ground as if anticipating the statue's collapse. Above these figural groups, the king and his horse, about to be pulled from their pedestal, are echoed in the background in the pyramidal shape of the half dozen men who have clambered to the top of a battery wall to watch the action. It's no accident that they look as if they too are atop a pedestal. By including this collective of anonymous figures, Ortel presages the future, a future that had, of course, already happened. As the monarch goes down, the people arise to take his place. Other artists of the time conjured a similar dialectic, but one of the things that distinguishes Ortel's picture is that he included several ethnic and racial minorities. For example, a black figure appears on the ground before the pedestal, and as curators at the New York Historical Society have noted, his appearance raises a number of questions. It's unclear whether he is free or enslaved, or what role he plays in bringing the statue down. It's also unclear if his presence signals the exclusion of African Americans from the civil liberties granted by the Declaration of Independence. The black man is, after all, painted in the most vulnerable position within the composition, as if he's about to become a victim of the falling sculpture. Or alternatively, as the Historical Society has also suggested, maybe his presence was designed to trigger an association with abolitionist discourses. In particular, the newspaper editorials written by William Lloyd Garrison in New York, in which Garrison argued that all Americans, black and white, should enjoy the rights of liberty claimed in the Declaration. What we can say is that by including only one black figure, the painter grossly underrepresented the population of people of African descent in late colonial New York. We know that freemen, as well as slaves, were numerous in the city during the 1770s, not to mention the 1850s. Black soldiers served in the Continental Army, and black sailors labored on British vessels and in shipyards around the Atlantic Rim. We'd be well advised, then, to follow the lead of a Historical Society curator who interprets Ortel's painting as, quote, an allegory, rather than an attempt to accurately recreate the event. The same holds true for the indigenous family in the painting, although they are larger, more visible, and more specifically rendered than the black figure. At an elementary level, this group poses two questions. Who are they, and why are they there? To what extent are they accurate representations of Native Americans, or rather, generic signs? Delving a bit into the artist's background helps to resolve these issues. It's likely that Ortel had little knowledge of and no direct contact with the region's indigenous population, in part because he had been in the U.S. all of 5 years before painting this picture. Ortel immigrated from Germany in 1848 and quickly established himself as an engraver to publishers in New York. Later, he became known for his many religious scenes and was ordained as an Episcopalian minister. Ortel's undertaking of a painting about colonial iconoclasm may therefore seem incongruous. What motivated him to produce such a challenging picture and to include an indigenous group within it? Quite convincingly, curators at the New York Historical Society have suggested that Emanuel Leutze's painting of Washington crossing the Delaware may have inspired Ortel to try his hand at depicting an episode from the American Revolution. Leutze's enormous canvas, it's much bigger than you see represented here. His canvas was the talk of the town of New York between 1851 and 1853, when it was displayed to the acclaim of thousands of spectators. If Leutze, who was also a German artist, could achieve success with a scene from American history, then why not Ortel? Perhaps Ortel conceived of his picture as a kind of prologue to Leutze's. In Ortel's rendering, one George falls, signaling the end of an empire. In Leutze's, a different George arises, signaling a national future. In other ways, too, the paintings share important qualities. Both offer national stories with transnational casts, and both are rife with fictions. As scholars have long observed, for example, the flag above Washington's head did not exist in the 1770s. Ortel took liberties with his painting, too. It's improbable that women and children attended the tumultuous event, or that this figure, whom John McRae would later very dubiously identify as Alexander Hamilton, authorized the statue's destruction. This inventiveness extends to the depiction of the indigenous group. New to the United States, Ortel may have been better acquainted with artistic renderings of Native Americans, which circulated widely in both the U.S. and Europe, than any actual Native Americans. Indeed, there were very few members of the Native Lenni Lenape tribe still living in Manhattan by the 1850s. Ortel's male figure exhibits traits similar to George Catlin's portrait of a Wichita leader. Both are costumed in feathers, necklaces, and an animal skin over one shoulder. Catlin's portraits form the basis for many engravings, as well as his Indian gallery of performers and paintings, which toured Europe during the 1830s and 1840s. We might also note the resemblance between the headdress of Ortel's figure and that of Keokuk in Charles Bird King's portrait. These are both called roach headdresses. They're made of stiff animal skin that was dyed bright red and usually worn only for battles or for ceremonies. Keokuk, a powerful Sac leader, was frequently portrayed by Anglo-American artists. He featured prominently in the popular folio of lithographs published by McKinney and Hall in 1838, where we see the same colorful headdress plus a pendant and staff that are loosely echoed in Ortel's painting. So it's probably obvious what I'm driving toward. In answer to that question, who are these figures? It seems that Ortel has appropriated and combined features from well-known illustrations of American Indians to fashion his native group. These are not portraits of particular Lenape people then, nor even generalized representations of Lenape Indians, but rather generic signs of an ethnic category, American Indians. As such, they feature in much the same way that this Mohawk man did in Benjamin West's much reproduced painting, The Death of General Wolfe. The Iroquois were key to the British defeat of the French during the Seven Years' War, but here, on the Plains of Abraham in Quebec, that military role is downplayed in favor of a passive representation that renders the Mohawk warrior as a stereotype of the noble savage. This offers one answer to that question. What are Ortel's Indians doing here? We may read their action of turning away as symbolic, as if they represented the passing of one phase of American history and the dawning of a new era, as the New York Historical Society has posited. Or perhaps, as the Society also suggests, they may foreshadow things to come, namely the marginalized role of Native Americans in the nation's future. Either way, their presence says less about the participation of indigenous peoples during the Revolution than it does about the cultural politics of the mid-19th century. By the time that Ortel had arrived in the U.S., the visual trope of the noble savage was giving way to the more contemporary ideology of the vanishing race. As scholars have explained, there was some measure of truth to this concern. Western contact had led to the decimation of some tribes through disease and warfare. And even by 1830, the passage of the Federal Indian Removal Act displaced large numbers of Indians to reservations west of the Mississippi. Anxieties about the disappearance of entire cultures led George Catlin to embark upon his project of visually documenting tribes in the Midwest during the 1830s. Within this context, Ortel's 18th century Indians, who appear to be leaving the scene of what was quite literally a tipping point toward nationhood, may be understood to embody 19th century premonitions of a vanishing race. About 6 years later, John McRae revised Ortel's image for an engraving that at once diminished the visibility of Indigenous presence while substituting other energetic Native actors for Ortel's family. In McRae's engraving, the only member of the Lenape family that remains is a version of the man. But he's been displaced so far backward into the space that he's almost hard to discern as part of the crowd. Meanwhile, in the foreground, McRae added three figures, two men and a boy, who not only cheer on the destruction of the statue, but also charge into the scene to help out. Their costume and tools define them as laborers, and in a pamphlet that was printed to market the engraving, McRae specifically identified them as blacksmiths. Even more specifically, he described them as, quote, some natives of the country aboriginal. He even gave them names. The taller figure was Oliver Woodruff, and his assistant was Joseph Warner. Although I haven't been able to locate historical records for people matching these names, I think the sheer fact that McRae named them would seem to endow these individuals with a degree of historical agency that Ortel's figures lack. Yet at the same time, this is a kind of agency that these figures can only attain when they're evacuated of visual signs of indigeneity. McRae's words assert a Native identity for these figures that is only gestured at in the engraving, which implies only a hint of ethnic differentiation through the darker skin tone and hair of the figures. Nor does his image include costumes of the sort that we saw in Ortel. Indeed, McRae has displaced the most obvious signs of nativeness into the half-hidden man that he refers to merely as the Mohegan, the Indian man with the ceremonial headdress who stands behind Woodruff like a shadow, a ghostly double, a noticeably more passive presence. The discourse of critical race studies developed over the past two decades has taught us to be attentive to cultural constructions of whiteness, as well as to constructions of blackness and ethnicity. We might ask then how the many images that represent the statue's destruction not only celebrate iconoclasm as a founding moment of nationhood, but also delimit it, normalize it, as a history of and for Americans of Northern European descent, even more specifically of Anglo descent. Black and Native Americans, when they appear at all in these images, occupy unstable positions and are sometimes made to perform their own displacement. Like the dust cloud that engulfs the statue upon its fall in the digital Ortel, their visibility is compromised by assumptions about their relevance within a national story. Surrogation operates here, then, as a process that is as much about the forgetting of a Native America as it is about the forgetting of a royal America. As told by Ortel, but rehearsed in so many other history paintings of this period, the rise of a white democratic citizenry, signified by the group of anonymous men who crown the plinth-like form in the background, requires the erasure of the indigenous other. Perhaps this is why depictions of Bowling Green proved to be so regenerative throughout the 19th century. If the actual destruction of the king's statue was understood to signify the end of a political order, the representation of that destruction created a space for reimagining and reinventing the present order. National reinvention was an especially pressing concern during the 1850s, for the middle decades of the 19th century saw not only growing friction between white settlers and indigenous people, but also the rise of abolitionism, the stirrings of feminist protest, and the growing divide between North and South that would eventually erupt into civil war. In an era that threatened disunion, the country needed a unifying figure more than ever. We tend now to picture Abraham Lincoln as fulfilling that purpose. But tall as he was, Lincoln was overshadowed by the president who just kept on coming back. the big daddy of them all, George Washington. The so-called father of the country, a heroic general and the founding president, Washington had been the subject of a culture industry of images, or rather a cult of images, since his death in 1799, nearly 60 years prior to the installation of Henry Kirk Brown's sculpture in Union Square. The sculpture referenced an important day in American history, the departure of British ships from the port of New York following the end of the Revolutionary War. This happened on exactly November 25th, 1783, and it was an event that was celebrated for decades in New York City as Emancipation Day. To the best of my knowledge, it's no longer a holiday, but people would have work off from the day and no kids would go to school. Here, facing south to New York Harbor, the victorious Washington hails the defeated troops in a magnanimous gesture of goodwill. By marking the conclusion of the Revolutionary War, the statue thereby figured a bookend of sorts to the act of iconoclasm at Bowling Green that New Yorkers understood to mark the Revolution's debut. In American art history, the sculpture has been celebrated as the first permanent statue of Washington on horseback, as the first bronze equestrian statue fabricated in the U.S., and as a triumph of sculptural naturalism that marked a break from Americans' dependence on European neoclassicism. And that argument has been advanced despite the obvious connection to imperial Roman iconography, in particular the famous statue of Marcus Aurelius, the so-called philosopher king, who likewise extends his right arm in a gesture of benevolence. More interesting to my mind than these retrospective evaluations is a certain sensibility that was lurking in contemporary reception of the Washington statue. New Yorkers of the 1850s saw the phantom of George III in the statue of George Washington. To put it differently, they saw a surrogate, a royal monument displaced but not entirely replaced. Surrogation operates differently here than in the Ortel painting, for it involves not just the forgetting of George III, but the complicated reinvention of an age-old iconography for a country that insisted on its youth and originality. The problem that Brown tackled in his equestrian monument was that of appropriating a sculptural form that had been associated with European kingship, including many British monarchs, ever since Marcus Aurelius. The problem was how to make something new out of the old, how to supplant George III with George Washington. In some ways, this was a challenge that had been going on since the end of the American Revolution. In 1783, the U.S. Congress voted to erect an equestrian statue of Washington at the site of the national capital. Now, this was problematic because that site had not been determined in 1783 and would not, in fact, be settled for another 17 years. Perhaps that uncertainty accounted for why no actual statue was realized for decades. In the interim, though, several Americans imagined where else a statue might be located. Notably, a number of them suggested Bowling Green. In the best-known print to articulate this idea, Washington stands in close visual proximity to the only part of the Royal Monument that still remained on site after 1776, the pedestal of the royal statue. Some New Yorkers reimagined this ruin as an abstract memorial to the Revolution, an accidental cenotaph, and greatly regretted its removal in 1818. In Cornelius Thibault's engraving, Washington poses against a view of British troops departing the port. Here, as in the Brown statue, he marks Emancipation Day. In his right hand, he holds an important document, the farewell address he delivered upon leaving his second term of presidency. It was the speech that would usher in a new president, John Adams. Notably, in the curious spatial collapse of middle and background that this print achieves, the farewell address appears to dangle directly above the pedestal, as if to suggest that with a flick of the wrist and a smack of the paper, Washington has bid farewell to the king and assumed his place as a sculpture. Nearly 60 more years would pass before Americans finally got their equestrian monument. Installed at Union Square, the statue quickly became the subject of interested artists and spectators. It was decorated with garlands and wreaths every November for Evacuation Day, as you see in this postcard, with love from Cousin Mamie. It formed the centerpiece of civic celebrations like firemen's parades. And it was the focal point for huge political rallies that occurred at Union Square during the Civil War. This stereograph shows a flag captured from Fort Sumter in South Carolina, which was the first of the states to secede from the Union. The flag has been placed in the right hand of the statue. Such events and such images effectively remade a statue that had been created to remember the end of a war into a statue empowered with the agency to lead a new generation of Americans into battle. Moreover, the civic events that occurred around the statue in Union Square made the square itself into something in between what Pierre Nora has called a lieu de mémoire, an official, state-sanctioned place of memory, and what he called a milieu de mémoire, an environment of memory continually remade through oral and bodily action and performance. And I think this is very much true of the Washington Monument in Union Square today. In the weeks after 9/11, the statue was remade into an ephemeral peace monument, as you can see on the right. And as recently as the Occupy Wall Street movement, it was once again a meeting ground for political demonstrations. I'm straying here a bit from issues of surrogation, so let me come back to that question of how antebellum New Yorkers saw George III in George Washington. In quieter moments, moments of non-political action, some observed a resonance between the colonial and antebellum statues. A few writers duly noted that the Washington sculpture was the first equestrian monument in the city since the days of British rule. For others, it triggered nostalgia for a bygone colonial era, one that was already being reimagined in highly romanticized ways. Let me give you just one example. In 1869, as the country was licking its wounds from its latest civil war, Sarah West published a book entitled Spectacles for Young Eyes, New York. This was part of a popular series of books about and for children that introduced major American cities. In this volume, an American family returns from an extended sojourn in Europe and resettles in Manhattan. Visiting Bowling Green, the father regales his sons Peter and Tom with the familiar tale of iconoclasm. When Peter speculates that the statue must not have been very attractive because it was made of lead, this is at the bottom of this page, his father corrects him. It was covered with gilding, Peter. That is a different thing, the boy exclaims. I should like to see him standing here if he was shining gold. That childlike sense of longing for a bright, shiny thing, and no ordinary thing at that, but a colonial approximation of a distant English king, is aroused again a few pages later by Tom's encounter with the Washington statue at Union Square. The sight of the monument prompts Tom to think of the lost statue of George III, the story of the leaden soldier that was cast into bullets, and he then draws a quick analogy to his own toy soldiers, which he sometimes melted down. Nearly a century after the imperial statue was removed, its memory continued to haunt the material landscape of New York. As I've tried to suggest this evening, we may regard the Ortel painting and the Washington sculpture as key moments in a process of surrogation that had been ongoing since a crowd toppled the Royal Monument in Bowling Green. Both objects contributed to a continual process of memory formation that was also a process of national remaking, a process that entailed the suppression of bodily doubles, namely the statue of the king, as well as certain living bodies, namely American Indians. We can further trace this process through the pictures and objects that formed the expanded visual field of New York City in the 1850s, a field in which colonial settlers displace indigenous populations, a field which continually resurrected one father figure only to substitute him for another. And let me note that this was also rehearsed in American literature too, most notably Washington Irving's Knickerbocker stories and the images that they inspired, including John Queedor's pendant paintings representing the story of Rip Van Winkle. In one story, Rip awakens from his long slumber in the Catskill Mountains north of New York City to learn that President George had succeeded King George, and here that shift is mapped in the portraits that appear on the tavern signs. If Ortel's painting and Brown's statue played especially formative roles in remembering and reinventing the American Revolution, neither object settled or resolved this process. Surrogation did not, does not go away. In the early 20th century, King George came back. He first appeared in the form of a sculptural reproduction of the Bowling Green statue, presumably made out of papier-mâché or another ephemeral substance. The statue stood atop a parade float that formed part of the Hudson Fulton Commemoration, a multi-week celebration of New York history that marked the colonial founding of Manhattan in 1609. The float purported to reenact the iconoclasm at Bowling Green, although as you can see, it doesn't appear to have been especially dramatic. And I think it's worth noting that the statue really couldn't come down, otherwise there wouldn't have been very little to look at along the parade route. Nevertheless, the pageant inspired some members of New York's colonial revival movement to suggest that a new monument to George III should be raised at Bowling Green, on the site where the destroyed one had previously stood. This idea was met with enthusiasm as well as outrage. Some New Yorkers even proposed a counter-monument for Bowling Green, namely a statue representing colonial protesters pulling down the statue of George III, a veritable mise en abîme. And this is just one of the newspaper articles that appeared in 1910, and as you can see, it suggests at the very bottom, why not erect a group representing the destruction of the king statue by the Patriots? Neither proposal was realized, but this drawing was. In 1912, a local artist named Charles McCubbin Lefferts imagined what the royal statue might have looked like before its destruction. It's a noticeably spare and crisp image, one that centers the monument within a space altogether devoid of people, one that betrays no hint of the statue's eventual demise. It is also an image, I would suggest, that brings us full circle. For it resembles nothing so much as the many images of Union Square that represent the Washington statue from this flat angle, towering above its pedestrian surroundings. Lefferts, in other words, may have looked to the immediate example of the Washington statue to reconstitute the appearance of the lost royal statue. In so doing, he inadvertently reanimated the forces that link iconoclasm and surrogation all over again.